Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To bringing design closer. Our goal is to have conversations that inspire and help move the dial forward for organizations to become more human-centered in their approach to solving complex business and societal problems. Can you believe it? But this is HCD is 5 years old. We've just passed 200 episodes on Apple Podcasts, and we've been creating content regularly for that period of time. And if you want to help us out, there's two things you can do. Number one, you can leave a review for us on any of those platforms that you're listening to, such as Spotify or Google or Apple. And even if you don't want to leave a review, that's totally cool. You can go one better by telling people that you work with or you know that might listen to podcasts that might like the show. Help spread the word. In this episode, I speak with Michelle Walter, Head of Design Ops at ANZ Bank in Australia. I've been connecting with Michelle for a number of months about all things strategic design in ANZ. And ANZ were my bank of choice in Australia, not out of a deep loyalty or anything like that. They weren't the most innovative banks for a very long time, but in September 2017, they made a really big, ballsy statement, I felt, and they hired Ofer Yontov as a chief design officer for the bank, and also Michelle Walter as well as the head of design ops. In this episode, we speak about length around the growth of design internally at ANZ, what worked for them, what didn't work for them, and how to take the business on that journey as well. They currently sit at over 200 plus designers. So how do they hire for those 200? Is it purely a skills acquisition that they're looking for, or are they hiring for purpose? This episode is a really good peek behind the curtain of an organization that went from, say, a stage two in the design maturity ladder where design is used as style and styling all the way through to where they are now. And according to Michelle, it's used to inform strategy. So stage four. Michelle is truly awesome, and I know you're going to love them. So let's jump straight into it. Well, well, well. Michelle Walter, I am delighted to welcome you to Bringing Design Closer. For our listeners, maybe start off, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for having me. So a little bit about me. So I am from Melbourne in Australia. I was born here and I've lived here basically most of my life. I have spent the last 7 or so years working at ANZ Bank. We're one of the largest financial institutions here in Australia. We're one of the big four, as they call it. We also have one of the largest in-house design communities from last count. We have 210 designers and, say the word designers, all different disciplines of design. So we have
nice
UX designers.
I know that there's lots of stuff we can talk about based on the amount of designers that you have there at the moment. But maybe tell me, what's your role in ANZ?
So my role is head of design operations. My role and my team are very much in support of enabling our designers to do their best work. Being a creative inside a large, complex organization has its challenges when a lot of our designers just want to get in there and do great work. So a lot of what we do in design ops is remove roadblocks. We put in processes and practices, but really one of the things that we focus on is building a culture of design, fostering creative community. And we also focus on upskilling our designers and supporting them in their growth and development.
Right. So there's a story that I'm going to come back to in a little bit more about ANZ and my kind of understanding of ANZ. But when you say a culture of design, what does that look like in your eyes?
So a culture is one where I think creatives are open to sharing There is so much goodness and knowledge and expertise within our design community. And I guess for me, it's really thinking about sharing that more broadly so others can learn and grow themselves. It's also about collaboration, not just with our designers, but how designers work with the rest of the business to really create impact in what they do. So they're probably the main things that I think about when we think about the culture. And also, I guess design is not just limited to just designers. We have different stakeholders across our business that actually understand the value of design, so we're not sort of sitting in this quiet corner or under the basement somewhere in our building doing what we do. We kind of share the love and the knowledge and our expertise with the rest of the business.
Just on that, it's very easy for us to build a design culture with 210 designers when they're all in one corner of the building effectively. Design culture, when it permeates the rest of the organization, I'm interested to know, what are the kind of things that you've come up against when suddenly over the last 8 years, is it? Maybe it's been more probably since Ofer Yomtov arrived in the CDO position. What are the challenges from the organization around justifying 210 designers?
So I'd say that the challenge or the opportunity for design is really around changing the mindset from being very much a culture of deliver fast, being very product oriented, where decisions are being made by product managers and I guess senior managers, and kind of flipping that on its head to saying, well, what do our customers want? And thinking about user needs. So it's definitely a mindset shift, and to be honest, also a cultural shift, where we've had a lot of people work in the organization. They're really smart people who've worked there for a really long time, and for no fault of their own, they're used to kind of their way of working. So bringing something like a design process into that, which I guess, you know, in some people's eyes can take longer or have more steps or, you know, spending more time with customers. You know, of course, there are challenges with that, but there are some really great areas of the business that have embraced design and really embraced, human-centered design, I guess, as a methodology, and had some really great successes.
But I guess I'm an ex-customer of ANZ. Like, so when I was in Australia from 2003 to 2018, I was an ANZ customer, had my mortgage, that everything, like, you know, I was all in with ANZ, which annoyed some of my other clients when I was working at CBA. I was like, I'm all right with ANZ, that's fine. But the systems that were in there when I first signed up in 2003 were exactly the same systems that when I left in 2018 in Australia. So I can imagine that there's people there that have been just used to these systems that are probably in place, or maybe at the point of kind of being sunset. What kind of things did you do, or are you doing, for people that have been in the organization for a very long time, who may see, as you said, design as being an additional layer of complexity? Are there trainings? I'm kind of interested in that piece. Like, you know, like, how do you bring them along on the journey?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think you're absolutely right. So there's legacy systems and a ton of complexity still. But the good news is that there are, again, some really smart people in the organization and leadership that are really trying to change that. And there's, great new product offerings, and they're absolutely, you know, so many teams are really trying to fix the plumbing. So that's the good news. But in terms of, thinking about teams adopting design, I would say that our approach has been working with them and not sort of talking at them. So one of the things that we do is we've started to run HCD masterclasses. So it's quite common in sort of large organizations, but it's not your traditional masterclass. The sort of half-day sessions, it's much smaller. So they're smaller teams that come in, and they're highly engaging, they're highly collaborative, and they're really generative. So it's not like you have a bunch of designers who will talk at you for 4 hours, give you a whole bunch of tools, and us as a team, we kind of cross our fingers and hope for the best that something will stick. We really invest the time in the masterclasses and follow-up sessions. So in project coaching, we do a lot of, again, really taking that kind of people-first philosophy and putting that into practice. So no one likes being told sort of, you have to do this and you have to embed design. But I would say that our philosophy is really a bit of a slow burn. You know, give them a little bit, they can come to a masterclass, maybe they can walk out, you know, knowing a little bit more about prototyping, and they might try prototyping on their project, and then we find that, you know, it's incremental, and then it sort of branches out a bit more and permeates out to other teams and more interest, rather than this kind of push attitude where, you know, we come in the big HCD army, teach everyone design, and again, you still cross your fingers and hope for the best. So I guess in summary, sort of smaller teams, more intimate interactions, and that sort of slow burn by, you know, trying one thing or two and seeing if it works.
So what is the team structures like? What do the team structures look like, should I say, within a typical project at ANZ, and how does that differ to other places that you might have seen or might have experienced?
Yeah, so it depends on the project, but some of our more, more business type projects would have, you know, hopefully a sponsor.
It's always helpful.
They might have a product owner or a business analyst, like quite traditional. So people that would come very much from the business with a business mindset with a focus on delivery. So they even might come with a whole lot of ideas, which is great. They might even come with some solutions that they kind of just want to implement and, again, that delivery mindset and get out the door. But I guess what we try and do is really understand the problem that they're trying to solve, really take the time to understand those stakeholders. So, they might be in a squad. So ANZ, part of our business is set up in the Spotify model. So we might have a squad that we'll work with. So really sort of understanding the different roles in there. And understand how they want to work best. And I think what's important when we try and bring HCD in is we really try and understand what part of the project plan they're at. The ideal is we get brought in at the start of a project, but it doesn't always work that way. So we just try as we can, is to understand kind of where they're at and I guess meet them where they're at.
Okay, so in terms of, I know it's how long is a piece of string, or, you know, each project is different, but are there disciplines of research, or disciplines of service design, or disciplines of user experience? Is that the hub and spoke model that you're referring to? Like, do we have a central team of experts that drop into certain projects? Would you be able to tell us what that looks like from a day-to-day perspective?
So we're not really set up in that way. So a lot of our designers are embedded in cross-functional squads.
Okay.
But we do have a smaller pool of designers that are mostly strategic or service designers that would get pulled into certain projects that are high priority, or, you know, on a senior executive scorecard. And they need, you know, they need designers really to work with them, particularly in the front end of a project. But most of our designers are embedded in squads, so in different product teams or service teams, spread right across the organization. So we're very much set up as a distributed design community at the moment. So we're in Australia, New Zealand, and India. And we've been running that way for about almost 4 years now.
Right.
Prior to that, we were set up very much as a kind of in-house design
agency.
Yeah, which very much worked in that way, where a project would come in and we'd kind of pick and choose from this sort of centralized design team. And we'd send them off on assignment or on a project, and then they'd kind of return to home base, you know, to anywhere from 6 to 12 months.
Okay.
Pros and cons of both models, I have
absolutely
to say.
Yeah. It sounds like you're pretty far up the design maturity ladder, if you're using, you know, design as a strategic tool, if you want. So how are you using the research that's been basically explored, and how does that inform the new bets or the new strategic pieces that are going to come into play?
Yeah, that's a great question. Again, it depends on where the product development is or the kind of project plan. But what we try and do very much at the front end is if there is a project and they require research at the start, we kind of swarm to that and make sure that, you know, we're iterative on how we run research, that we're brought in at the start and throughout the project, and just feeding those insights as best we can. Mindful that many projects try and run quite fast. So it can be a challenge for some of our designers, and also different stakeholders along the way have, you know, different, I guess, different takeaways from the research as well, because the customer might be saying one thing and then there's their point of view as well, and they're the product manager. So there's that tension as well. So stakeholder management is actually, you know, one of the most important skills that we can teach and support our designers on, because they're, even though they might be in a squad or they might be brought in for a, you know, a certain phase of a project, making sure that that kind of stakeholder management piece and everyone's kind of happy and is really important.
One of the common problems that I see from speaking to lots of organizations is the glass ceiling for design is usually pretty low in the organizational hierarchy. And designers don't see anywhere where they can go. But I remember, correct me if I'm wrong now, okay, I'm trying to remember back, Ofer Yomtov's hiring in the CDO created ripples. And I was working in government at the time. And I was like, well, ANZ, they hold my mortgage. They've hired a CDO. They take design seriously. That must be good. Yeah. And I was, at that time, I was a little bit cynical. I was like, okay, see you along. This lasts. Okay. And I wanted to see where it was going to go, because I remember I used to do work with CBA. The career growth for a designer tends to move out of design and into the business function.
Yeah.
What does a career trajectory look like for an ANZ designer at the moment?
Yeah. Well, the good news, as you just mentioned, is that
he's still there.
He's still there. Ofer is still there. He's my boss. And I'm really grateful that I get to work with someone like him. And that to work with someone and for an organization also where design has a seat at the table. We talk about it all the time.
All the time.
And it's a really powerful recruitment tool, I have to say.
Yeah.
And really an engagement tool. And when we think about retention, Ofer is very present with our design community. And I guess he has a pretty strong kind of, mindset where even if you're a CDO, you do not take your kind of eye or hands off the tools. You're still a designer. You know, I think that really resonates. So he's kind of with the people, for the people, which is really great. And, you know, I think that what he has shown to our designers is that over your career, you can reach this level. And there are organizations that are, you know, open and willing to put design, an executive of design, which is just a great story.
Yeah.
But to your point around career progression, so you can come in as a grad. We have a great graduate program. We haven't had many designers, but like coming out of pure design school in the last few years coming into that program, but we'll be taking grads next year, which is great.
Do you have an affiliation with a uni?
Sorry?
Do you have an affiliation with a specific university in Australia?
No, but there's just not specific, but there's a few sort of well-known ones, RMIT, Monash have a really great Swinburne, have a really great design.
All Melbourne-based universities. What about the ones up in New South Wales? Customers
UTS,
up there and students as
there
well.
There we go, UTS. Hey,
okay, yeah, there you go.
But look, UNSW. There's also some... Sorry. There's also some really great independent institutions as well, like General Assembly do a really great job. Academy XI also do a really great job to help designers get into industry. So they do a great job. And then you sort of work graduate, and then I wouldn't say we have a really strong sort of junior level of designer. We don't even call them juniors. You just become a designer. And that really depends on the breadth and the depth of the skills and your experience and really your attitude, I would say. We have a lot of kind of few years out of school or maybe they've only had a few years work experience, and they are unbelievable. Like they're just incredible. So we really, really foster that and really support them on their growth in that space. And then it goes quite traditional from there, to be honest. It's sort of senior, then you become a lead.
And so forth. You go through. So one of the questions I had, and it seems from speaking to lots of the designers in ANZ, from just having conversations with you guys over the last couple of months, you all know who you are, and this sounds a little bit too deep, but you're very, you know what this is about. Okay. There's no deviation. Like, so each people are, they stand alone as strong individuals. So how do you hire for this? Because it didn't seem that that's been left to chance. And if so, if there's a recipe that you want to try and share with us, how do you make sure when you're hiring people that it's actually improving the culture? Because it's such an important thing. At 210 people, law of averages, you're going to have a couple of people in there that mightn't fit the mold.
Yep.
And also, I want to talk a little bit more about agitators after this question. So just maybe start off by telling us, like, how do you hire and what are you looking for?
Okay. So I'll probably go back one step. When I started at ANZ, we had no process to hire. Right. We had 11 designers.
That's when they reached out to me.
Yes. I had 11 designers, really small team, and no process. Where's the interview guide? Where's our recruitment partner? Surely we have one at ANZ. Lots of questions. So I'm really curious, and I'd never worked in a large organization. So I asked a couple of peers at the time, where's all this stuff that we need? And to be honest, we built a lot of our frameworks. We created the process, and even like 6 or 7 years ago, design ops as a function really leaned in into the recruitment process. That was the priority. Build the team, find the right people. We want diversity of thought, really, back then. Yeah. We want designers from all different backgrounds. We spent a lot of time in kind of the setup of recruiting the designers. And then we saw this great opportunity because when they landed, they're like, they sold the dream and we've got all these great people in, and the onboarding experience is rubbish. They don't even know how to turn on their MacBook. They can't connect to the network. And then again, we saw this opportunity to create a really great onboarding experience. So we spent time. So we spent time with them thinking about, what a great recruitment experience would look like, finding the right partners, finding the right people to run the interviews. We didn't even know how to do that. And right through to how do we make them productive from day one, and how do we give them a really great experience for their first 6 to 12 weeks, however long they needed us for. And that took time. A lot of like dark bags under our eyes. But I would have to say that kind of the years putting systems and a process and, kind of simple artifacts in place to really get that engine going really paid off. And as part of that, We were supporting hiring managers who weren't from design. So that meant that instead of, again, if I went back, we had hiring managers just hiring any designers. They were like, well, I need a designer. A designer would turn up to an interview and they're like, you sound okay. And we're like, did you see their portfolio? They're like, what's a portfolio? We're like, oh, right, okay. So, yeah, really, really, I guess, supporting our team and then supporting the business that were hiring designers outside of our team was really important. And we, when I say support, it was from writing job ads right through to that onboarding experience. So, and we still do that today. So it means that we hire the right designer most of the time, of course.
Sometimes
we get it right. For the right role. So fit is really important, like right discipline, right work, and we really make sure that fit is right. And then we look for cultural fit. For me, it's just kind of a bit of, I've done a lot of interviews in my time. I can probably tell in the first 10 minutes, it's just a feeling I get. That's there's no secret sauce there. So that's me personally. But I think that one of the, if I take myself out of it for a moment, one of the things we look for is, are you clear and intentional about the problems that you've tried to solve, how you've solved them, and what have you learned? It's like a really simple recipe that we look for when we interview candidates. If you can tell that story in a really clear way, you're like, 10 steps in already.
So any graduates listening to this, that's the secret sauce there. That's the kind of stuff you get out of this as HCD, folks. Save yourself some time and energy.
It's kind of that simple formula. And, you know, I've seen really experienced designers who will talk to us for half an hour about themselves. I'm like, you sound great. And then I had an incident recently where I asked someone who experienced. I said to this person, talk me through one of your projects. They're like, oh, but I've prepared five. I don't need to see five. Just show me your favorite one. And they're like, oh, but it's really hard to choose. I'm like, just show me one.
Oh my God.
Show me one and tell me a really great story. And we kind of got there in the end, but I think that balance of, if you can tell one to two stories really well, you don't need to spend hours and hours, preparing five case studies or five projects. And tell me about the ones that didn't go so well either. Tell me about the ones that didn't get shipped.
I think that comes with experience, though. And one of the things whenever I'm coaching people, and especially if they've been in an organization for a long period of time, the whole interview process and hiring process becomes this kind of, I don't know, difficult space to even talk about. And the more conversations you have, the more able and capable you are to talk about your work and what works and what doesn't work. And you write that first 10 minutes piece, you can just kind of feel at ease, kind of going, okay, well, I know I can ask them any questions. They've kind of done enough to be able to talk like that.
Yeah.
What advice do you give to people, though, who are new to design that mightn't have those five projects? And they might have just have one or two projects from university and they're looking to crack into get a gig at ANZ. How should they approach it?
I've done a lot of mentoring the last couple of months, and a lot of the conversations that I've been having are exactly what we're talking about. How do I crack in? I don't have a lot of experience. And I guess the advice that I come back to time and time again is be yourself. Don't apply for roles that are senior design roles and come to me and say, Nishi, I don't understand why I didn't get the job because they're senior. Think about, go to where you should kind of be at, and go for those kind of junior, go for an internship. So the first advice I would give is be quite specific and be really clear on the role that you're actually going for. And when it comes to presenting your work, be yourself. Be authentic and say, I've only got 1 year experience, but these are the three areas of design that I'm really interested in. And tell me why you want to work for ANZ from what you know. Why ANZ, not NAB across the road, or why don't you want to work for a startup? What, there has to be something that interests you about working at ANZ. And you could say to me or our team, I'm really impressed that you've got a CDO. It's like, oh, that's cool. You've done your research. That's great. Or I see you're building.
Michelle Walters there.
Yeah. Sorry.
Or Michelle Walters. Or Michelle Walters there.
You want to work with me?
Head
amazing.
Of design ops. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's always flattery is always a good one.
Absolutely. So yeah, that's probably the second thing I say. So be yourself, be authentic, kind of say where you're at. There's no kind of right or wrong. But the third piece of advice that I give is, if there are things that you do that relate to design, if you write on Medium, if you have your own blog, if you're making an app for a friend of yours that's a florist, put that on there. Yeah. Put any kind of design, any kind of your design work, whatever it is, put that on there. I'm mentoring a guy in Sydney and he's awesome and he's transitioning from being a project manager in architecture to design. And he started to write on Medium, which is amazing. He was like, oh, I was writing about bicycles and the design of bicycles. I'm like, great, put it up there, get it out. And just kind of simple things like, now it's on his portfolio and it's just a lovely read. Like it's
true to him. It says an awful lot that's true to him as well, I'm sure, like his own interests and his own passions. One of the things that I get faced with quite a lot, and I want to ask your perspective on this question, is somebody who maybe sees or hears about UX, okay, and UX is it's still a relative shiny bright thing to an awful lot of people, and they might do a course in it, but their previous role was, say, senior graphic designer or senior BA or any of these kind of things. And then they go for those jobs as senior UX people.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that? Where should they enter?
It's a hard one.
It's a hard one, isn't it?
It's a hard one.
Because they're bringing lots of other experience to the role. They're bringing, like if they're in a BA role, they'll understand an awful lot of the agile processes, presumably.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that, this doesn't happen in every case, but something that we try and focus on is, you know, what are the skills that this person might have at their core, and what are the skills required for the role? So if they are similar or there's a nice match, then we say, okay, well, you might want to transition, or a lot of the skills that you have are transferable. But I think it also depends on a couple of factors. The work to be done, the kind of pace, the velocity, you know, of the work, and also the team that this person is in. So sometimes people would ask, oh, you know, I'm going to go for this role at ANZ. I'm interested, you know, my background is leading teams, and I'm comfortable with that. And that's kind of where I want to continue my career. I might look up the role, you know, I've got the magic powers at the back end. I can understand a little bit about the team. And, you know, sometimes I'll go back to that person and say, you're not going to be in a people leadership role. So you will be on the tools, pumping out assets, you know, so I think just really understanding what the person is after with their skills, is that a match to the role? I mean, as best you can. I think that it could be a really good match, but it does put a lot of, I guess, a bit more work on the person who's applying for the role to kind of dig a bit deeper, and also for the person doing the interviewing or the hiring manager to really understand what they're hiring for and those skills that are needed. Because some are easily transferable, and others might not be, or might not be aligned from a, you know, career and growth perspective as well. So,
One of the things that we were connecting originally around was the learning and development program at ANZ. Now, as a kind of a big thing, we wanted to talk a little bit more around, you mentioned about this being an incredible way of hiring people. Tell us a little bit more around the story of the learning and development program and some of these uplifts that we're referring to.
Okay. So ANZ have a dedicated learning program for our designers. We started about 4 years ago. We ran a survey and we ran some interviews with a smaller design community then. I think we're about 80 to 90 designers.
Wow, okay. You've grown pretty quickly.
We've grown pretty quickly. remember, we started at like 11. So, yeah, we were about 80 or 90 and we ran some research and one of the things that we asked our designers was around, you know, how is ANZ supporting your growth? And I just remember looking at the results. I think we got like 1.5 out of 5. It was
really
abysmal. Yeah. And lots of great verbatim, great but like harsh. And basically there was nothing. It was really confusing. Some of our designers didn't even know that ANZ had some pretty solid, you know, growth templates and development plans and that kind of thing. And the other big kind of, you know, allergic reaction was to designers weren't having conversations with their managers about their growth and development. So it was a huge sort of opportunity. So we took that insight, series of insights, and we said, we have to do something with this. And we were trying to recruit pretty quickly. And at the time, which on reflection is a similar situation to what we're in now, you know, it's a really hot market. And even then, we had a lot of startups, all building in-house teams and, you know, paying a lot of money. And we just needed something to hang our hat on. So to make designers choose ANZ over the kind of startups or other companies. Down the road.
It's super, so, super competitive. I want to stress that to anyone else out there. Australia is really hot for really designers
small, and always has been. Yeah, a really small talent pool. So we thought, is there something in this around this idea of supporting our designers' growth and what could that look like? So as many great design projects started off as a very small brief, bit of a side of the desk, could we get this thing happening? And one of the things that we focused on really early on, which we still do today, is focus on skill development. So when we think about capability programs or, you know, uplifting mastery, we still come back to this idea of skills. So how can we support our designers to really build their skills and grow in those skills and support each other and, you know, maybe their teams on the skills that they've built. So we started writing, well, what does that look like? As a designer, what are the skills you need? We came up with 25 skills. We ran a whole lot of workshops. It was run as a very slick design project. We scoped it, we planned it, ran a whole series of workshops, which were really fun. Did a whole bunch of prototyping. I was reflecting the other day. Someone found some of our original prototypes in one of our cupboards at the office, and they were done on the photocopier. Remember that old thing, the photocopying machine? Yeah, black and white. And I found this beautiful black string from this stationery shop up the road. So I was hand stringing all these paper prototypes and sending it around to people across the business, to our designers. And that was a way that we tested and learned. So super, super low fidelity.
Yeah.
We even sent one of those prototypes to quite a senior executive and asked for her feedback. And she loved it. She was like,
"And what was it though? Was it a book or?"
It was a book. It was a book. Yeah. So it ended up being a booklet. Yeah. So a hand-strung photocopied booklet. And we kind of played around with this idea of, is it a booklet? Is it digital? And then we kind of went full steam ahead and said, let's publish a book. Published a book. Yep. We published a book.
Wow.
I'm going to show you. There's our book.
Wow. Nice cover. It's the back of it, is it? Or is the front of it?
And inside the book is, a description of all of our skills that we feel like our designers should have. And we described each of the levels of those skills. So when you're starting out at a certain skill, what does that look like? And when you're an expert, what does that look like? So again, being really clear and intentional about our expectations of our designers. And we kind of packaged it all up into just a small 126-page book that we gave out. It was very ceremonious, and that resonated.
The reason why I love that is I think it's so easy for us to kind of go, we'll do a website. That way we don't have to print it out. And that way then it can update and we don't have to.
Yeah.
And then some people might kind of go, and it's better for the environment too. Which we all know is wrong. Listen to Jerry McGovern's podcast on World Wide Waste, folks. But, I mean, the whole fact that there's something that's tactile and you have it in your hands and it's there is meaningful. And
yeah,
it shows absolutely. That there's something you can, you don't have to be online to watch it. It says an awful lot, like, you know.
Yeah.
There's probably a whole host of other things we can chat about at length around this and stuff, but you've got this thing, the learning and development program. We mentioned about it being great for hiring people, but how does it affect retaining people?
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to throw money at people and throw learning and development programs at people. Has that had an effect on churn, on people churn?
No, I wouldn't say, but it's definitely helped with engagement.
Wow,
our engagement scores. There's a really interesting. I think they run it twice a year now. It seems to change. I think it's twice a year. There's a bank-wide survey. They ask a whole bunch of questions. Yeah, around engagement, around inclusion, around risk, and one of the questions is, I feel like ANZ gives me the opportunity to learn and grow in my job. And we are fortunate that we can filter those results. So the survey goes to 45,000 people, and everybody in our system who identifies as a designer or an experienced designer, we can filter our results. We use that those responses as a way to measure the effectiveness of the program. And it's really powerful. Again, thinking about measuring success in a way that our business stakeholders and our sponsors would understand, and this survey is a really powerful way to do that. So year on year for the last 4 years, we've tracked those results, and last year, and they've gone up every year, which is incredible considering we've had 2 years of a pandemic. Last year, I think we hit 81%. And just as a really interesting data point, ANZ without the filter for designer, so how ANZ responded to that more broadly, they were at 76%. So the design community were above the kind of average for ANZ, which is really cool.
That's brilliant. I mean, it's a success story, but I've got one little last question, if you could just squeeze it in. And you mentioned about the metrics that the stakeholders are looking for. Can you tell us a little bit more what metrics they are, other than churn, which we discussed, like engagement was one. Are there any other ones that you're allowed to share?
Yep. So one of the things that's really important when we think about metrics for this program is every year we write our OKRs, but one of the things that we're doing more so in probably the last 2 years is we're aligning those OKRs to our strategic scorecard. So what do our senior stakeholders expect or want to achieve for the year when it comes to building capability? What does that look like?
Yeah.
And we're also asking our designers. So we kind of think about, well, what are the needs of our design community and how are we going to measure the success of the program based on that? And then what does the business need? So a really great example is on the scorecard, it talks about building capability in key priority areas. Pretty loose statement. And one of the areas is leadership. So this year we said, right, well, for our learning program, how are we going to focus on leadership? How are we going to show that there is a clear alignment between what we're doing and what the business needs? And helping them to kind of deliver on that scorecard. So we had, again, this kind of small idea that's turned into something really big and exciting, and at times a bit scary. We've spun up a different stream of our program, which is called Creative Leaders. And part of Creative Leaders is bringing a small cohort of all different types of design leaders. So you could be at different stages of your career. You could be a current leader, an aspiring leader, a people leader, a craft leader. And we've brought a small cohort together for a 24-week program. So really mm-hmm. intensive program where we're focusing on really uplifting their capability and their understanding of what an impactful design leader means at ANZ. So that's something nice. We're new. That's something new we're doing this year. And then we've got the other kind of skills that we're doing as the other part awesome. Of the program. But yeah, we're really focusing on that kind of creative leaders stream. We've never done it before. So it's really exciting, but it's a long program and it requires a lot of dedication and involvement from our designers.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a really great story. And for us, that alignment piece to what our senior stakeholders are asking to, you know, us to help deliver on for the year is really important.
Look, I've had such a good time speaking with you. If people want to reach out to you and find out more, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
I love LinkedIn.
You do, actually.
Yeah, I do. I don't have any, I'm not on any other social media, so you can't find me anywhere else.
All right. I'll throw a link to your LinkedIn in the show
you
notes.
You can find me. Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn, Michelle Walter. I am on there often. Please reach out. I'm always happy to talk about design operations. I'm always happy to talk about culture and community, which is really close to my heart. And I'm also happy to share a lot of the learnings that I, you know, myself and the team have come to, I guess, learn ourselves on our growth and development program that we've built over the last couple of years.
Michelle, thanks so much for your time and your energy. Take care.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Anytime. So there you have it. That's all for this episode of Bringing Design Closer. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisis8cd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. Now, if you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is HCD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network. And also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisishcd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.